Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 26 of the FASD Success Show. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate all the kind things people are sending me. It's great to know that people are listening when I'm just sitting here in front of the microphone, like right now. I look to my left, nobody. Look to my right, nope. Look behind me. Oh, there's my dog. Me and my dog, that's it, talking to you. And there is nowhere else I'd rather be. I love doing this. I'm having a really good time. People are liking it, so it is working. So let's keep going. So tell me, how are you? How are you doing? How are things at home? Is it chaos? Is it calm? Is it in between? Is it chaos and calm, and it switches every 5 minutes? I hope you are doing well. It is tough to be a caregiver to an individual with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and that's why we've created this podcast. That's why the name of it is FASD Success, because at the end of the day, I want you to be successful. As a former foster parent, I get how tough it is in the trenches. And I remember on multiple occasions saying, how can people live like this? Like, if you want to know some of my motivation why I'm doing this, is I've been in those situations saying, like, how do people survive this day after day after day? But there is a way, you know, through a lot of searching, a lot of talking, a lot of listening, there are ways to make not only you successful, but your loved ones on the spectrum successful as well. And that's what brings me to the guest today. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Wozniak, and it comes at a great time. This will be the first interview. First of all, I got to say this: the first interview where I don't have an extensive relationship with the guest. Up until now, I could call all of the previous guests, and they would hop on because we have that kind of relationship. But I also have to give it up to our producer. We're going to call her that. Her name is Yvonne Williams. She also has a Facebook page called Our Sacred Breath, and she's doing a lot of good work with Red Shoes Rocks right now. She's putting up like a post a day for 99 days. They have a campaign. Anyways, Our Sacred Breath on Facebook. And she's also working with me, and we'll call her a producer because she reached out to Dr. Wozniak. She knew that the choline study that he did would interest people, but we did not see that there was this yesterday. Even this, the article comes out from Channel 4, CBS in Minnesota, and they do a little video on it, on him about this, and they say, you know, the university announces breakthrough study on treating fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And it was in our group. It was in our free group, facebook.com/groups/ FASD forever. It went like wildfire, and people started saying, how much do I take? Where do I get it? What's going on? And it's like, whoa, 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 pump the brakes a little bit. I get that caregivers are looking for, you know, something to help, anything to help. And you've tried a lot of things and different therapies and, you know, different medications. And you know, you're just looking for that help, to help your loved one on the spectrum. I totally get that. But it was so interesting for me to see the reaction to this article. And having just literally the day before interview Dr. Wozniak about this. And it is so key because it was interesting for me to see, like a social experiment, how quickly people were to jump on it and without even reading what was going on. So what I want to do is I am going to actually play the audio from the article. There was a video done with the article, and I'm going to play it. And then we are going to go into the interview with Dr. Wozniak, and we'll just, you could see how it is way more in depth, right? A news article is usually so quick, but there is a lot more into it that goes along with the study. So I just want you to hear the clip from the actual news agency, which again is a CBS Minnesota Channel 4 WCCO. This clip is courtesy of them.
Considered the most serious substance to unborn babies. Doctors believe they're only beginning to understand the problems drinking alcohol while pregnant will lead to. But as we found, breakthroughs here at home will mean some kids will face brighter futures.
We always like to reiterate the message that there isn't a safe period for any alcohol consumption during pregnancy.
Professor Jeff Wozniak and his team at the University of Minnesota have dedicated a decade to trying to change the course for kids suffering from fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, known as FASD.
I think an important step in demonstrating that we can actually alter the trajectory of brain development.
New findings recently published in a medical journal point to promise. As part of the study, children 2 to 5 years old prenatally exposed to alcohol began drinking a nutrient called choline. Now, as some turned 10, Wozniak brought them back to compare the kids taking the choline with those drinking a placebo.
When we look further out at the four-year point, what we see are differences that are more pronounced, more noticeable.
Cognitive tests prove the kids taking the choline had improvements in memory, concentration, and problem solving.
It's validating to see that what we predicted would happen over the very long term does seem to be happening. This is just the first step in demonstrating that a developmental intervention can be powerful.
FASD is now believed to be more common than even autism spectrum disorders. One study found as many as 1 in 20 first graders suffer from the behavioral and judgment problems it causes. Wozniak says drinking even in the first few weeks of a pregnancy is enough. It's why he hopes for the kids where it's too late, his solution may soon be considered for widespread use.
Changing something small early on can have significant effects later on.
So that sounds amazing. It is amazing, right? To see that the abilities have improved by using choline. But there's a lot more to it. And how effective is it? And would you recommend that your kid take it? And I know everybody would have questions. Well, how can I get it? Would it help my kid? Because again, we're looking for anything. So I want to do this interview so we could take a bit of a deep dive into it and see if choline's right for your kids to take, if you fit in the window of where it works, and if not, it's not in the window and you want to take the choline anyways, then by all means, I just want to give you the most up-to-date relevant information, so when you are doing a therapy or trying something, a supplement or a medication, that you have the best information out there. So before we go to the interview, I have to read this man's bio, right? And so it's a doozy, and he deserves all of this because he is a super cool dude, but he knows his stuff. And let's just say, I'm going to read it right now. Here we go. There are a lot of syllables here, folks. This is going to be a challenge. I should have read it over numerous times, but I didn't. Dr. Wozniak received his PhD in clinical psychology at Kent State University in 1997, internship at the University of Minnesota in 1997, and a postdoctoral fellowship in pediatric neuropsychology at the University of Minnesota in 1999. He is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and adjunct faculty member in the Department of Psychology. He is a licensed psychologist in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Dr. Wozniak runs the Child and Adolescent Neuropsychology Clinic in the Department of Psychiatry, where he sees patients with a variety of neurodevelopmental, neurological, and psychiatric conditions. He also trains graduate students and clinical psychology interns in the practice of clinical neuropsychology. His clinical interests include neuropsychological evaluation of children with neurological and psychiatric disorders, consultations with schools regarding academic programming and modifications, and clinical training. Dr. Wozniak's primary research interest is in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and he co-directs the university FASD program. It goes on and on and on, but you get it. This guy knows his stuff. He did the study. please listen to him. We'll listen to the awesome interview and we'll come back and we'll break it on down. So as I say, off we go to the interview. Let's go. Here we are with Dr. Jeff Wozniak, former Golden Flashes alumni, currently Golden Gopher, just overall golden. Doctor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Appreciate that, Jeff. You forgot Badgers. Wisconsin Badgers is also in there, too.
Oh, is out? Oh, no, I thought I was being all suave for sure. But listen, totally golden. We love Minnesota Golden Gophers. We love Minnesota hockey. We love Minnesota hockey hair. So it's so good to have you. Thank you for deciding to do this, to join us, because we are talking today about a big issue that's happening in my group, again, facebook.com/groups/FASD forever. And that's a study that you did on choline. But first, I always like to get the origin story. How did you become involved with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
That's a good question, Jeff. I first became even aware of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders during the latter years of my training. So this was about 20 years ago. Actually, when I came to Minnesota, there was a psychologist whose name was Pinyin Chang, who had been running a clinic here for a number of years, since the 1970s. Where they were evaluating kids with FASD, specifically children and adolescents. And I got exposure to the group clinically and became very interested in, number one, the wide range of effects that we were seeing in kids who had FASD, some of the challenges around diagnosis. And as a neuropsychologist, or someone who studies the effects of the relationship between brain and behavior, essentially, it was a very interesting group to work with. And over the years, it became very clear to me that there was really not much happening in terms of developing interventions around FASD. So some of what we're going to talk about stemmed from my observations that there really was not a lot of intervention research happening.
Were you taught in medical school about FASD?
Well, I'm a psychologist, so I went to school for psychology, not medicine, but I work in a medical environment. I work in a medical school, and I also teach residents and trainees. So no, I did not have any exposure to fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, even as a neuropsychologist in training, until I reached the fourth and fifth years, the fifth year of my training.
Man, it's incredible, because your response is just like every other doctor that we have talked to so far on the podcast. It just, you know, isn't in the literature. People stumble upon it and then, you know, they get into it and it makes a lot of sense to people. So you have done, let's move on, because folks want to know about this choline. So I kept popping up. Now, the definition from the medical news today, and correct me on anything and everything if it is a falsehood. Choline is a nutrient that supports various bodily functions, including cellular growth and metabolism. The body makes some choline, but the majority comes from dietary sources.
Right. So that is a key point. The body does make choline, just like it makes other vitamins and components that it needs. But we also need to take in a certain amount of choline. And so we know what the recommended daily intake levels are like for choline. For the most part, people don't take in enough choline, just like people don't usually take in enough vitamin D and other nutrients with our Western diet. But something interesting happens with pregnancy. When a woman is pregnant, her needs for choline actually increase. So you oftentimes have a situation where the population as a whole is not eating enough choline. And then in the special status of pregnancy, you actually need to consume more choline, because it's so important for fetal development, for development of the baby, that the fetus robs the mother's choline. So women can actually become deficient in choline because the fetus is taking all of the choline. Now, what that tells us is, number one, mom is at risk and needs to be consuming enough choline. But more importantly, the fact that the fetus kind of steals all the choline tells us just how important it is for fetal development. That's just one piece that, that tells us that.
I was never, you know, I have a young 18-month-old young lady, Olivia. In all our appointments, we were never once when they talked about pregnancy and nutrition did they mention choline.
They probably mentioned folic acid. So that's a common one that women are advised to take folic acid supplements during pregnancy. If you take prenatal vitamins, you know, there's a hefty dose of folic acid in those prenatal vitamins. And that is because we know that's another nutrient. It's something that we eat, but also something that you want to supplement during pregnancy. That's an example of a nutrient where if you are deficient in folic acid, you will have higher rates of neural tube disorders. So you have these very significant malformations in the fetus, specifically in the development of the central nervous system.
Wow.
And that happens without folic acid. Now, most people don't know that we're all being supplemented with folic acid. In most countries in the world, if you consume anything that has flour in it, that's a processed ingredient that has been, folic acid has been added to it specifically for that reason. Most people don't realize that that's the case.
No, I did not realize it at all. Now, what, you know, it's for cell maintenance, metabolism, nervous system functioning. Where did you have the idea of it, like, improving brain function and individuals with fetal alcohol? Like, where did that, what was the basis of the study to combine FASD and choline?
It wasn't my idea. I'm one of the people who's implemented it in human studies. But the ideas come from basic science. So scientists who work with models in the laboratory, including animal models. And so a lot of the inspiration for what I've done with choline in humans has come from Jennifer Thomas's group at San Diego State University. And others who are using animal models to look at what happens to brain development when there is alcohol exposure prenatally. And so some of those groups studying animal models started to look for things that they could try to ameliorate or reduce the effects of the alcohol during pregnancy. And choline was tried at some point because there is large literature on its importance in normal brain development. And so the idea was, can we try something in an animal model that is good for normal brain development, increase the levels, and see if that helps offset some of the damage that happens from alcohol? So a lot of the ideas for the human studies came directly from the basic science, which is, in my opinion, the direction that things should always go, that we should be trying things in a systematic way, and there should be a logical scientific basis before we look to them to have impacts on humans.
Oh, that's, yeah, quite true. So you did this study, and it wasn't a short study, 9 months, correct?
Right. The people enrolled in the study are administering choline to their kids, and these are 2 to 5-year-old kids, for 9 months every day.
So what did you see? What did the like, did you have, did scientists go in saying like the hypothesis, or did you have an educated guess of what you thought might happen? Or do you just say whatever the science says, I'll look at the results?
Well, I think you've hit on a couple of key points there. One is that we always have hypothesis or hypotheses, one question that we're asking. We always state those questions up front. Just to give you an idea, nowadays you have to register your idea on a website. In this case, it's an NIH a government website where you register the trial beforehand and you say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to measure. Here's how many people are going to be involved in the study. And then afterward, you report the results. And the reason for doing that is that that makes for good science, that people, other scientists can look at and be confident that you weren't just cherry picking the data and pulling out the things that look good and ignoring everything else. You state everything up front, you design the study, you run the study, and then you report the results. So we did that. We've been doing this work now more than 10 years, and it has evolved over the course of the 10 years, which we can talk about. But the initial study was designed to be feasibility and tolerability. We wanted to know whether kids with FASD, 2 to 5 years of age, would take a supplement, and would parents be able to administer it, and would we have any negative effects, like kids having upset about taking a substance every day, things like that. So that was the first part, was to just look at safety, tolerability, and feasibility.
And what did you find? Were they open to it? Because it would almost be like a med in terms of a supplement, right? Was there resistance from some? Like, what did you see?
All right. So part of what we had to do was develop a way to get it tolerable, to palatable to kids. Two-year-olds don't necessarily want to be swallowing pills. They can't swallow pills. They're not going to take a teaspoon of oil every day. So we had to develop a fruit-flavored drink mix to make it possible. And we had a lot of good collaborators help us with that. And it was very tolerable. So there was no difference between the choline group and the placebo group. The placebo group receives something that's very similar tasting, but doesn't have actual choline in it. And so there was no difference between the tolerance for those two things, which tells us that the choline wasn't having a negative effect on anything related to the body that people noticed and would reject.
So you administered it for the 9 months. Did you check in periodically? How did that work?
Yeah, we did baseline testing. So we evaluated the kids' intelligence, their cognitive development, their memory skills. And in that first study, we were really focused on memory because choline is a key component in one of the major neurotransmitters in the brain. It's called acetylcholine. And so you need this nutrient to make this neurotransmitter that's very much involved in memory. And we know that choline has effects on parts of the brain, the hippocampus specifically, that are involved in memory. So we did memory testing before we administered anything, midway through the study and at the end of the study, as well as some general intellectual testing. And we also looked at behavior. We're very interested in how any interventions we do might affect kids' behavior. What we saw in that first study was small effects at the end of the 9 months on the child's ability to do a basic memory task. And they were kind of in line with what we expected. We didn't see, let's say, a change in their intelligence over the 9 months with choline compared to placebo. And that was pretty much exactly what we were expecting to see. This is not a treatment that we expect to see a dramatic result the week that you start administering it. This is more like a long-term intervention that has a subtle effect on brain development and that we think we might be able to measure over long periods of time. So that very first part of the study was the 9 month part. Now we'll talk about the 4 year part in a little bit here, which shows us something different. But that first part gave us pretty much what we expected to see, which was small effects within the area of memory and not for all kids. So we saw that the kids who were supplemented at a younger age, let's say 2 to 3, had more of an effect than the kids who were older, say 4 to 5. This turns out to be one of the key pieces that we need to talk about with choline, in that this is not a treatment that is going to work across the entire age spectrum. This is an intervention that has effects on brain as it is developing at a very early age.
Thank you for clarifying that, because in the effort to parents want just what works, and they're always looking and how can I best help my kid? And then they hear, one person say, oh, I tried choline, or, oh, here's a study, choline. Now it's like this miracle and it helps the brain development. And, oh, even, you know what else I've heard? Taking choline, after a woman finds out, she was drinking during pregnancy, can erase the effects. Like this is, and then parents get swept up in this. And so that's why I said, I got to talk to the scientists, man. Because you're saying small changes, not for everybody. And this is not like a pharmaceutical, like where you say here, 2 weeks, you should start seeing some changes. It's not like.
Right. Right. It's really more like a vitamin. And we expect long-term kind of effects. So let me make a couple comments about things that just came up in what you were just saying there in the last couple sentences. the reason why we think it is effective in the young ages, and that would include prenatal, we think that if we could give this prenatally, it would probably have even more effects. And there are some studies that are looking at that.
Sure.
We have seen some sort of kind of mixed effects, which I can talk about. So the reasoning why the early ages, because the brain is doing a lot of development during the first, the first year of life is tremendous brain development. The first 3 years of life, there's still a lot of significant brain development and cognitive development happening at a very rapid pace. But even into the fourth and fifth year, there's still some development in the hippocampus, these structures that are involved in memory functioning. Now, a lot of that sort of tapers off, and the change, the very profound brain change, kind of flattens out, and there's obviously growth and continued development, but a lot of the rapid stuff that happens really happens in those first couple of years of life. So that's where we think a nutrient is going to have an influence. One of the other things we think this nutrient does is it affects gene expression. So I mentioned that it is a building block for neurotransmitters, and that's important. But it also it affects the way genes are turned on or off. So as the brain is forming in the first few years of life, a lot of genes are being turned on or off, having to do with, how big is this cell going to grow and where is this cell going to move in the brain and how is this cell going to connect to another cell? So turning those genes on or off are very important. And it turns out that choline is essential to the process of turning a lot of those genes on or off.
Oh, nice.
So if you have a deficiency in choline, you may have an effect on brain development. That's reason number two for the early intervention. I think that kind of explains why we expect that this is really going to be only an effective intervention at very early ages. And so I don't advise people to be using choline in, 18-year-olds, for example. Yes, there's learning happening. Yes, our brains are always developing to some extent. But for the most part, the way that we think this interacts with brain development is a very early phenomenon, like the first 2, 3, 4 years of life.
Which is phenomenal because this is something we did not know, 10 years ago when you guys started this.
Right. This is a direction that is really still in its infancy, and we don't know everything about this yet. But it's a step in the direction toward intervention that we didn't have before.
I agree, and I think that's so important. And thank you for bringing up in the older ages. Diet and nutrition and it is obviously very good for the brain, but expecting that choline will somehow have this dramatic sweeping effect in develop the brain further or rapidly is just not what the science is saying, correct?
Yeah, it's not what the theory, the scientific ideas suggest.
Okay.
It's not what the science in other areas of, animal studies suggest. The studies haven't been done in older kids. There is one study that it was that choline was tried in adolescents, and they didn't find an effect. It was a little bit of a shorter term study, and there may have been some other factors there, but so far the evidence that we have is that in the youngest kids is where we're seeing the effects, and that was like 2 to 3. One other point I wanted to touch on that you mentioned was that what do you do if you have been drinking and then you find out you're pregnant? And so people are looking to choline and other interventions for repair, essentially. And I think what I would say about that general question is, yes, this happens. And this is, number one, not a situation to panic, but it is a situation to take significant steps. So when we advise a woman who's pregnant, who has been drinking, the first step obviously is we advise to stop drinking. That will have a beneficial effect on the remainder of the brain development that is happening for the fetus. So stop the drinking, the tobacco use, the other drug use. Number two, optimize all other aspects of that pregnancy, and that includes nutrition. So not necessarily running out and taking choline, but ensuring really adequate nutrition during the remainder of the pregnancy, because there is brain development happening, you know, and that continues beyond the pregnancy. So breastfeeding and ensuring that the child develops good nutritional habits during the first few years of life are all parts of optimizing brain development in the face of what may have been damage as a result of alcohol. So are we reversing it or are we optimizing everything else that's happening? I would probably lean more toward we're optimizing everything else that's happening and maybe working around some of the damage that might have happened from prenatal alcohol exposure. Oftentimes we won't know you know, what the effects of any specific alcohol exposure were until well after the fact. And so that's another reason we don't advise people, you know, panicking about that situation or making assumptions about what the outcome is going to be. But we do suggest that really try to optimize the rest of the development.
Agreed. And very well said. Very, very well said. I like that. Optimize nutrition and optimize what you can do. Because, you know, panicking can almost make it worse with the production of cortisol, right? So that's what I, you know, from Dr. Gail Andrews from Glenrose in Edmonton, you know, stress plus lack of nutrition could really have an added impact. Now, if you don't mind, unless there was any other points to make about this, you did talk about the long term. You said that if you wanted to bring that up, because then I wanted to go right into what the parents are asking, what they're saying, because I love to get their answer, their questions answered. You know, they don't have the opportunity to sit in front of you, so I'm on their behalf.
Okay, well, let me say one more thing.
Yes, please. You can say 10 things, honestly, Dr. Goa. This is your time, man.
So we did do a follow-up study. So I mentioned the original study was 9 months. We tested them before we gave them choline or placebo and right after we ended the 9 months of choline or placebo. We then followed up as many of those kids as we could much later. And on average, that was about 3.9 or 4 years later when we saw them again. So they hadn't been taking anything in the interim for the most part. Nothing that we were giving them.
Sure.
And we looked at their cognitive development again, because now development is a little bit like, we think like a lever, or like, you know, if you think about a seesaw, you push down on one end and you get a big effect on the other end, depending on where that point in the lever is. So if you start early and you make a change developmentally, you might expect a bigger effect later on, the further on out you look. And that's pretty much what we saw at 4 years, was that there were significant effects on attention and cognition that we were not able to detect at 9 months. So we think that it's, we've always thought that it's additive. Development is additive.
Sure.
If you make a change early on that, let's say, affects the hippocampus or the brain's basic memory system, there are going to be a lot of added pieces over the years that will benefit from that very early foundational change that you made. And that's exactly what we saw at 4 years. So that raises several issues. One, you know, we can't look for the change immediately. We have to expect that these are long-term kind of changes. And we have to think about child development in the very long time frame, that what we're doing, we have to have trust that what we're doing now is going to pay off in the future. And we have to be willing to do studies and fund studies that look at the very, very long-term outcome.
The individuals on the spectrum, it is a long-term game, right? Everything, because with this maturity, behind developmentally, the last episode was by a parent, Jody Culp, right? You're Minnesota, right? And it was called the 40-year parenting plan. That's what she says she's on. And, you know, maybe not as long, but kind of we have to look at the long term development of these guys, not just till they're 18 or whatever other preconceived notions we had of what development looked like. This is especially for individuals on the spectrum. Success takes longer and it looks different.
Yep. I think that's exactly right.
Awesome. Well, I should just end the interview there because that's probably about as high as I'm going to go with you. But here we go. This is Jessica asks, is there a dose-response relationship?
That's a good question. So if we're talking about, some people ask that question about alcohol itself, is there a dose-response relationship? And yes, we think there is, that more alcohol exposure is worse for development, but it's not an exact relationship. For choline, that's one of the things we're proposing to do and hopefully get funded to do starting sometime this year. Awesome. Actually, I have a grant that's being reviewed in next week that is exactly that.
Good luck.
Look at the dose. We're proposing to look at three different doses. So I don't think we know the answer other than some of our data. We have sort of an imperfect measure of dose in that we had the same dose for everybody, but we had kids who were different sizes. So larger kids essentially got a smaller dose per kilogram of weight, and smaller kids got a larger dose. And when we look at that relationship, what we saw is that there may be a dose that is too high, essentially, where a child is having some of the we wouldn't call them even side effects, but one of the effects of taking choline is that if you take too much of it for your body weight, you will excrete it in your sweat and your urine, and you can have a smell, a fishy odor. So we've tended to see that at the higher doses, and we didn't see a particular cognitive benefit of the higher doses of choline. So I would say the general answer is no, we don't think higher doses are necessarily better. We think maybe a sufficient dose in the right Goldilocks zone may be the key here.
Someone saying they have three people, loved ones on it due to high blood pressure. Do you see that happen?
That people are taking choline for high blood pressure?
Yes. I cannot wait to hear this. That's three people I love are on it due to high blood pressure.
I'm not aware of choline being used as an intervention for high blood pressure. It does have a couple of other kind of medical uses. It's sometimes added as a nutrient for people who have certain undernutritional statuses. But I'm actually not aware of it being used for high blood pressure. One of the things we monitored for in our studies and are continuing to monitor for is blood pressure, because if you take very large doses of choline, you can have hypotension or low blood pressure. But those are typically seen at very high doses of choline. So the doses that we're using, we didn't see any effects on blood pressure in the kids that we were studying. Now, if you're looking at, 60 and 70-year-old people with chronic heart conditions, that's a completely different story. And any studies about choline in those populations would be almost not really translatable to what we're talking about.
Fair enough. Yep. Thanks. That's a great answer. Okay. This is, you might have already said this, but it got a lot of likes for this question. Okay. What are the best preparations for children? What dose was used in the study? What was the study methodology? Were the studies randomized and controlled? And I can repeat it if I need to. Is there any evidence that choline may help with other intellectual disabilities such as ADHD? Or in children who may not have been exposed to alcohol in pregnancy, but were exposed to other drugs?
You're testing my working memory, Jeff.
Okay, well, we can take our time.
I'll go through them, and you remind me if.
Okay. What are the best preparations for children?
One that they will take. I mentioned that we use the fruit flavored drink mix. This is something that we're actually manufacturing with a pharmaceutical compounder specifically for research, and we can't sell that or distribute that in any way. There are a couple of preparations that are out there. We're using choline bitartrate, which is one of several forms of choline. There's some evidence that maybe different forms of choline are more bioavailable, or they're more able for the body to absorb and use. But we used a dose of 500 milligrams initially of delivered choline. So that's calculated based on how much choline is actually in the choline bitartrate. So it's not 500 milligrams of choline bitartrate, it's more, but the delivered dose of choline was 500 milligrams. Now, there are published data on what the recommended daily intakes are for kids. In our age range, it was about 200, 250. So we were trying to kind of double that. And we found that probably was a little bit higher than we would optimally like to see, because some of the kids were having that fishy odor that I mentioned. So we are currently using a 22 milligram per kilogram dose, and I don't yet have the data to tell you exactly how that compares, because we're still collecting that data. And then I mentioned we're going to be hopefully doing another dosage comparison study. I would say that we can't advise exactly on dose, but all I can tell you and what's published is that the 500 was probably higher than what was necessary, and that what we're currently doing is basing it on weight, 22 milligrams per kilogram. The format of choline, varies, and you can buy choline in all kinds of different forms. I would advise people to be careful. This isn't completely innocuous. We don't necessarily know everything that there is to know about giving choline. You don't necessarily know the quality of what you're buying when you buy things on the internet. Mm-hmm. You want to buy things that have some certification, either from USP or otherwise, or from reputable sources. And generally what we advise is, with kids, you can do a lot with diet, so that not just thinking about supplement, but also thinking about diet. And the USDA has very easy to look at tables of choline contents in foods. If you search for USDA, that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and choline, and you will find tables in which the choline content of foods is listed. So, for example, eggs have a large amount of choline in them. So, teaching a child to eat eggs and to have a reasonable level of consumption of foods that contain choline is also another way of supplementing.
Did we already talk about that, about the study methodology?
Yeah, our study methodology was randomized controlled trial. All of our trials have been that way. So that's the gold standard. You don't just look at what people are eating and do a correlation. You actually assign people randomly. You're going to get choline, you're going to get placebo. During those studies, they're double blind, so the The family doesn't know what the child is receiving. I don't know what the child is receiving. We do all of the analyses blind to that so that we're not biased in the way that we look at the data.
That's good insight. Isn't that tough, like, about being a scientist, because you want a certain outcome, or is it just your curiosity to see the results? Like, because that's some good discipline to not know and to not, and that's to, so you don't have any, like, bias, and when you're writing it, that's, like, how do you deal with that?
It's hard, especially when you're talking about studies that take 5 years or 10 years to do. It is a challenge to keep doing the work, not knowing exactly what's happening and waiting until the very end to get a result. That is a challenge. But we set things up that way to maximize the credibility of the study. Otherwise, it's open to poking holes in it.
And that comes from peer review, correct?
Yes. All of these studies have to be peer reviewed, and they don't get published unless a group of anonymous people who are scientists reviewing it feel like it is good quality. So just to give you one example, the first paper that published on choline, I think, went seven or eight rounds with the reviewers back and forth, revising the paper until it was accepted for publication.
Jeez. And so that's why I say follow the science, not the salesman, because you guys are like as unbiased as possible, looking at the data. This is what the research, this is what the science says. It's not what, you know, Dr. Wozniak says. This is what the numbers say. And that's so cool. You're being so transparent. I really appreciate that. The other question was about, have we noticed any evidence of choline on abilities like ADHD?
Does it have effects on other conditions? There haven't really been studies. There have been a few animal studies that have looked at conditions that involve intellectual impairment, like Down syndrome. Now, those are animal studies, animal models of Down syndrome, and they have seen some similar kinds of positive effects for the brain. But those studies haven't been done in humans. ADHD has tremendous overlap with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as I'm sure all your audience knows. So many kids with FASD have attention problems, have hyperactivity. And, you know, while those studies haven't been done separately outside of ADHD, one of the things we're looking at in our studies is what does choline do for attention and for behavior? And in fact, the four-year study that I was talking about, we did see that choline had some benefits for attention as rated by the parents at that four-year time point that I was talking about. So then the kids were about 9 or 10 years old on average at that point. And you can start to see the effects of attention.
That's what you mentioned, like, for, because you talked about the foundations. If the foundations are there, right, the rest, it's a cascading effect on the rest of the building blocks and the development, right?
You sound like a neuroscientist, Jeff.
No, I just talk to a lot. That's my job, is to bridge that gap. Right. You know, parents are dealing with the day to day meltdowns, and they don't have time to do that and to look for it. And so I'm just saying, because they're all asking for it. So, you know, and Yvonne, who's so helpful to me, said, dude, look at all this stuff from Dr. Wozniak. I'll reach out. And you just so happened, you were so nice. Just a couple more questions. And then I have some of my own curiosities, if you don't mind, if you have a few more minutes. What's the youngest an individual can take choline?
Well, the youngest that we've done is two and a half years of age. And that's partly for practical reasons, that is an age at which we could identify enough kids who we think have FASD, and that we could get them to take a supplement every day. If we could have done the study in infants, we would have done the study in infants. But it's a lot harder to identify a group of kids at that age, at let's say 1 year of age or 6 months of age, who've been exposed and who we think have effects. And then you have to get into supplementing infants, which is a lot harder to do. The other type of study that's been done is prenatal. So Tina Chambers and Claire Coles and Julie Cable, some of these investigators have been working on studies in Ukraine. There's also been some work in South Africa. Joe and Sandy Jacobson have done that work, and others, their colleagues in South Africa. And so we're starting to see some of the data from those studies. And there are some positive results, especially from the South African studies, where the mom was supplemented during pregnancy. And there, if your audience isn't aware, South Africa has the highest rates of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in the world. There's a lot of historical and cultural reasons for that in a particular subgroup in parts of South Africa. And so there it's possible to find women who are drinking heavily during pregnancy who are straightforward to identify. There aren't the same cultural barriers to acknowledging alcohol use during pregnancy, and to supplement them. And so some of the Jacobson's work has shown early evidence that there are attentional differences in the kids who received choline, and a couple of other small cognitive changes detectable very early on in you know, the first 2 years of life so far. They're just getting to that point.
I understand.
So that fits with the science. We think that choline would have even bigger effects if it were administered prenatally. It's just we wanted to study the postnatal development, because that's when many of these kids in our situations get identified.
That's a great segue. Is there an effort to get choline in women's prenatal vitamins? That's from Aubrey.
There is some. There is some choline in prenatal vitamins. Unfortunately, it's not enough. So it's listed as the one of the ingredients on many prenatal vitamins, but it's in very small amounts, nowhere near the amounts that are being done in the supplement studies. So, for example, while the folic acid content in prenatal vitamins is sufficient to, you know, meet the needs of development, the choline that's in prenatal vitamins is really pretty minuscule. Part of the issue there is that just the bulk, if you added all the choline in that needed to be there, or that we think needed to be there to offset alcohol, it would be a large amount of vitamin to be taking every day. It is in infant formulas as well. So, and there the amounts are a little bit more in line with development, objectives for development. So infant formula manufacturers have caught on to this. And choline is very important for eye development as well, which the eye and the brain kind of develop at the same point. So if you see marketing around infant formulas for brain and eye development, that's probably what they're talking about, choline and DHEA.
This has been so insightful. And anybody listening, when you're listening, I hope there's no more, you know, debate. And so just to recap, your study, you found some changes, like it was before five, right? Before 5 years old.
Right.
So you found some changes, but not in everyone. And it is more of like a long-term part of foundational nutrition. And it's not expected to be like a pharmaceutical, a 2 week in your system changes made, less effective on children over the age of five, correct?
Well, we've only tested up to age five, and we found it less effective in the 4 to 5 year olds compared to the 2 to 3 year olds. The one study that our group was not involved in that was done in adolescents didn't find an effect at all. And that's kind of consistent with what we expect, is that prenatally and very early years postnatally would be where we would expect the effects.
Excellent. So now just a couple of things that I'm curious about, because I also see it in my group. So I wanted to make sure I talked about it. You know, PhD in clinical psychology, neurobehavioral development, that is you. So you're also a familiar with MRIs. And also what has come up in my group is the QEEG.
Mm-hmm.
What is the full term for that?
Quantitative EEG is usually what people are talking about when they're talking about QEEG. So EEG is electroencephalogram, which is a standard way of measuring brain activity in a very, very coarse way. So this is, you know, you put electrodes on the head and you're measuring the electrical signal that's coming off the brain through the scalp. This is different than an MRI. An MRI, you're actually essentially taking pictures sort of with the brain,
yep,
where you're looking at the way that oxygen is being used in the brain if you're doing a functional MRI. EEG is looking at the electrical activity and with sensors on the head. It's been around for, you know, many, many years, long before MRIs were around. But the idea with quantitative EEG is that you are measuring things related to the electrical activity of the brain in a way that you can put numbers to it and measure differences depending on what you're doing as far as an intervention goes.
Now, so, let's put our caregiver hats on. Is it beneficial for a caregiver to get the QEEG on their kiddos on the spectrum?
Well, first off, I'll say I'm not an expert in
fair enough
EEG or QEEG. What I would say is that the diagnosis of FASD is based on qualities that have to do with the physical development, so facial development.
Mm-hmm.
It's also based on knowledge about alcohol exposure. And so we have established criterion for diagnosing FASD. And that does not involve an MRI. That does not involve an EEG. It does involve neurocognitive testing. And what I mean by that is performance testing of a child's intelligence, their memory ability, how well they pay attention.
The brain domains.
What's that?
The brain domains. You guys,
yes.
You look at the 9, and in order to get to qualify, you have to have dysfunction in minimum of 3 of those.
Right. And those are performance-based. So literally, you know, a child's vocabulary compared to other kids the same age, or a child's, how many items can they remember? 3 items or 6 items? Compared to what's normal for a 10-year-old. So we have very sophisticated measures of things like that that are built on thousands of people that are titrated across ages. So that does figure into the diagnosis of FASD. Things like MRI, which I spend a lot of my time doing MRI studies, but I can't advocate for the use of MRI in the diagnosis of FASD, nor do I think that EEG has a role in the diagnosis of FASD.
Right. Well, I talked to Dr. Catherine LaBelle up in Calgary. They're doing a mental health study using MRIs, but she says, you know, a single MRI is not beneficial. It's not conclusive. It won't because the it's so minute, right? Like maybe the areas of dysfunction, but in a group MRIs, looking at that data is helpful. Right. I want to make sure that we're protecting our parents and caregivers because FASD is expensive. They've already spent a lot of money in therapies. And for example, I told Julian's a new member in our group, that I would ask you specifically because she was contacted by the director of a neurofeedback clinic and was told that a QEEG would be able to show what areas of the brain are damaged and that neurofeedback therapy could heal those damaged areas. I hear neurofeedback come up often. I know you're not an expert in that, but is there any science in your professional, personal opinion on the effect of that therapy?
Well, I'll say a couple things about it. In general, yes, parents need to be aware that there are a lot of treatments or interventions for which the science is not very specific or is non-existent. So either the science doesn't exist or it doesn't specifically apply to what their child may have. So these things range across everything you can imagine, having all kinds of different interventions. So that's a general statement, that you need to be skeptical of interventions in general, and look for, you know, actual evidence. One of the hallmarks of a treatment that is problematic is if it applies to too many conditions, be skeptical of that. So, for example, choline applies, we think, very specifically within a time window of the first couple of years of life. Right. And we're not saying that it's going to affect a child's learning disabilities, you know, their reading disorder. And we're not saying it's going to change their likelihood of developing schizophrenia, and it's going to affect their gastrointestinal health. You know, it's a specific targeted intervention, and that's based on specific tests of that theory. So I would say, if you're looking at treatments that are out there, evaluate how broadly they're being advertised. And if they're being advertised very broadly for everything from ADHD to learning disabilities to behavior to depression to anxiety to tics to emotional problems, then my skepticism level goes up when I see too much of a cure-all type phenomenon. I think that's a good general strategy for parents mm-hmm. to take.
That's excellent.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I would say about neurofeedback, biofeedback, techniques that basically train a person to be in touch with some bodily system. And that's essentially what the feedback part of those things are involving, is that potentially there are benefits to that. So like biofeedback, for example, is teaching people to learn through an electrical device what's happening with their muscles. And it could be muscles in the scalp or muscles in the neck, for example, muscles in the jaw. And so people can learn, for example, to take control of those muscles, those automatic muscles, and to reduce the tension in their jaw so that they don't grind their teeth as much or have problems with TMJ or other kinds of jaw pain. So there is a very real benefit from doing feedback, of being aware of bodily functions that you're not normally aware of by using some sort of an electrical measure of that. With the brain, it's so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. It's not a muscle, and it's extremely complex in terms of what's happening there. So, you know, I think it's a much harder thing to do, and it's a much harder thing to demonstrate. And again, I would look for specificity, very, very clear. I know of people who are doing, techniques involving electrical activity and the brain around tics. And that makes sense to me, because tics are motor, you know, they involve muscles, they involve very direct connections between brain activity and muscles. And retraining a system like that makes scientific sense. And I've seen some evidence for it. When we get to very broad things about retraining the brain, rewiring the brain, and you see it being applied very broadly for everything from learning disabilities to ADHD to emotional functioning, then I think you really need to be a little more on guard about how you're evaluating those interventions. I'm not saying that they're not effective. For some kids, doing that kind of feedback work where they are being coached and they're learning to concentrate on something that they didn't previously pay attention to may have some benefit, but I would be expecting small changes. I would be expecting specific changes, and I would be not expecting a child's grades to go up or a child's behavior extreme behavior outbursts right. stop, or you know, those types of outcomes.
I appreciate you saying that. There's Dr. Jackie Pye out of Edmonton as well. You know, neuroscientist. She has a video game, Caribbean Quest, but it's with a coach, mm-hmm. and the goal is if they can stop and think for a millisecond longer than they would have. That is the goal. She says it's not. She says it's not this game where it's going to increase their plasticity and do. It's like so small, but they can make a big difference. Like you're saying, in the long run, because that half a second between thinking and impulsivity, that could make all the difference, right? And I know you're being general in some instances and careful. Do you find, especially with your choline study, that the media takes what you said and then they blow it out of proportion? Have you had that happen?
I try to work with the media to really give an appropriate perspective so that it is understandable and so that it is tempered, not extreme, mm-hmm. not black and white. But you know, media is oftentimes short and to the point and very needs to communicate in a way that doesn't allow a lot of room for
conversation.
So I don't know if the media, I don't think I blame the media for doing what they do with science. I think some people in the media are very careful in terms of how they report on these things. Some of the media around fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is problematic because people tend to politicize the issue. They tend to put a lot of blame and shame on the issue around FASD. There's a lot of stigma. Mm-hmm. They tend to make it an issue about rights and freedoms instead of just a science-based issue. So FASD and the media, it can be problematic in terms of how things get reported. But interventions, I think, what I've seen so far, they've been, I think, reasonably reported.
Okay, awesome. That's great insight. My very last question for you. Well, like, what's next? You have the grant, right, for the dosage study for choline, but what else are you doing? What else are you working on? Where should my audience go check you out? Like, tell me what's happening in your life, doctor? What's going on in the future here?
Okay. We have a pandemic. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Yeah, I've heard some things, yep.
So some things have stopped as far as research goes. Fortunately, we're looking to find ways to keep research going during this really, really difficult time. So I'll just mention that. One other study that we finished recently that might be interesting to your audience, this was published in a journal called Brain Stimulation, is we actually are looking at stimulating the brain. This is kind of the opposite of the EEG thing that we mentioned, where we put electrodes on the scalp and we actually stimulate in a way to kind of excite the cortex, the outermost layers of the brain, while we're doing cognitive training. So you were talking about coaching. We're talking about here having a child do a computerized test where they are systematically increasing their level of memory or attention, using computer games that are stimulating and interesting. And at the same time, we're giving a little bit of electrical stimulation to the brain. So we've tested that. And in one of the studies, we actually found that that little bit of stimulation enhanced the cognitive training that we were doing. It's another area that's very new, very much in its infancy. You know, that was a randomized controlled trial. Again, we didn't know who was getting what intervention. So we're setting these up to test them in ways that are very scientific. And, you know, seeing little bits and pieces of evidence that they might be useful strategies. The advantage of that intervention is that we can do that in all ages. We don't have to do that in, you know, 2, 3, 4-year-olds. We can do that in 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds. So that's kind of what we're working on right now.
Gosh, you're like the real-life Egon Spengler. That's what I like getting these about. Like, you're curious and you're doing it, and it's so helpful. You're right. Everything has changed. So looking at ways to keep research going in a pandemic, to continue your work, I think what you're doing is awesome. You have just cleared up a lot for me, and now I can reference here, listen to the podcast, because you know I am not a doctor. I'm not qualified in that. And now we're not trying to take the hope away from parents. We just really want to temper expectations, say this is what the science is really saying. We're just really getting started. A lot of people are doing a lot of good work. That takes 10, 20 years for really the science to catch up to it. So on behalf of myself, and I know my whole audience that are going to listen to it and love it, like, thank you so much. And will you come back and do another podcast in the future, or did I butcher any chance?
Jeff, I love what you're doing. I've been a follower of you, and you may not remember, we were on the stage at one.
I was going to mention that.
In Minnesota. So I think you're a fabulous spokesperson, a very unique spokesperson for FASD, someone who really is an advocate, but someone who also digs into the science, and you're so articulate about all of these things. I'd be happy to come on your podcast again.
I appreciate that. I wasn't sure if you would have remembered that. I remember getting the call the night before saying, you know, Sterling wasn't able to make it. Would you be on a panel? I thought it was a parent panel. So sure, no problem. And then they started introducing all of you guys. And I tell you, if I had Ativan in my pocket, I would have had some that day, I tell you, because, you know, it was so intimidating. But you guys were so approachable. Immediately, I was able to relax. And you're just the type of people and the scientists that we need so I could get the word out. So thank you so much for joining me, man. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Awesome interview. Am I right? And I will definitely have to reach out to his assistant to get him a gift card for saying all of those nice things to me. What a nice guy. It was true. It was one of my first conferences in the U.S. I went to. Pulled up on stage. Not pulled up, but did not expect to be up there, especially not without those guys, but they were so nice to me. But let's get to this, because it was so interesting when you actually listened to the person who conducted the study and correlated it with the article. And the article didn't get anything wrong. It didn't, but it just wasn't long enough to really give you the scope of it. It was interesting how he mentioned how the fetus robs mom of the choline. And so maybe you're hearing this. Maybe you are, a prenatal nutritionist, choline, 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 get them that choline. You know what else struck me was all of the work and effort that goes into doing such a study. The fact that he had to register on the website and have the who, what, why, where, when, everything done. And then to do, you know, the study for all that time, not knowing which child was in the control group, what child was getting the placebo, and just looking at the data, because you've started this venture, you are so curious to see what happens. That's tough, man. I always say researchers are rock stars, and they really should be put on the forefront here, because they are doing all the work to bring guys like me the information so I can then transfer that to folks like you. And I think it's a great relationship, but we have to give kudos and props to what they go through. And even the longer term study to see, ooh, I wonder what happens, you know, when we run into these guys 4 years later. Here's the thing that we know, though, right? More of an effect on 2 to 3 year old kids than there were from 4 to 5. And he said there was small effects at the end of the 9 months. At the end of the 9 months, they found improvement in the child's ability to do a basic memory task, which in itself is amazing. But here is my point about reading something and going 1,000 miles an hour with it. Once you see an article like this, stop, research, look more, see if your guys do qualify
for it. And he talked about it, how it being that there was small effects in the memory, but not for all kids. And he also said this is not a treatment we expect to see a dramatic result the week you start administering it. It's more, it's like a vitamin. It's like a prolonged period. The genes expression, and it turns off the genes and on the genes, and it creates a building block, which is amazing. I don't think I could reiterate enough how awesome this is and how big of a news this is. But to, if you're not in that tight window to taking it, and as he wouldn't even recommend it for adolescents, and hoping that it's going to be some big turnaround, or you read a quote, you know, even in my group or on another Facebook page or in another group, and how, you know, it's miraculously like help their kids. And I just want us to take a step back, look more at the research before we get into it. And again, I know we're so hopeful, and we need to be hopeful, and this is hope. But it might not have the desired effect that you might think on your kid if it's not in this small window. But it's exciting to know if they are, this is it. Also, he didn't even recommend going out and getting it. He said you don't know where it is, what kind it is, where you're getting it from. He suggested going to look for the foods that have choline in it, like eggs. And there was the website that we'll have in the show notes at our blog at fasdsuccess.com/podcast. You could get all of the show notes in here. It's amazing to hear about the studies, the beginning studies in women who are drinking while they're pregnant. Like, this is all excellent stuff. I just don't want you to get your hopes up and to spend the money on things. And that's why I asked about the QEEGs. That's why I asked about neurofeedback. And it was great to hear from him that there are lots of treatments where science is broad and non-existent. That sets off a red flag for him. And he's a scientist. So you may be possibly taking that tool as a parent. And if someone is recommending a treatment and it's not specific and it says it cures all types of things. He even mentioned that biofeedback is good, right, with the muscles. But then he said with the brain, it is a totally different animal. Now, you go and do whatever it is you want to do. My stance is that you are the expert on your kid. Please, I will never ever tell you what to do with your kid. You've had enough people do that, and I'm not in the game of doing that, but I am in the game of bringing you the right information so you could go ahead and make the best decision that you can as possible. You know, and so again, he doesn't recommend older people take it. It was more effective in 2 to 3 year olds than it was in 4 to 5s. And he said there was another study that they did where they saw in older kids and there was no effect at all. He said it was a shorter study, but it's still great. It's still fantastic. But don't expect, he said, it's like a vitamin. It's about a long-term strategy, which I even told him in the interview that it's congruent with what I'm hearing and what we're hearing from other guests of the podcast, that it's a long-term. There is no miracle here. There is no fix it. You know what fixes it? You know what turns it around? We can make the symptoms better so they could live a fuller, useful life. That's what this is all about. You know, works is training, actually knowing about the disability, getting some good fetal alcohol training so you know why they're reacting the way they are, and so you can provide accommodations that are unique for your kid. But there's more that goes into it. You know, we even have to look at our own grief and loss and look inside ourselves before there's change. It's long-term change. And the good news is, man, I've been working hard behind the scenes. Once a year, we have our free a video training series, which I get into what is fetal alcohol, not only what is fetal alcohol, but I train so you can explain it to others, because I know that's a pain in the ass. I know that provides so much hardship to folks, trying to explain it to other family members, friends, the school. So, you know, in our video series, free, we teach what is FASD, but also we teach it in a way that you could teach others. And not only that, how to talk to others, you know, like your mother-in-law, maybe cough, cough, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And then we give a plan. So it's a really beefy, meaty, and we are working super hard. I'm hoping to have that within the next month for sure. So if you want to know more about this, by all means, please join our Facebook group, because there's over 5,500 caregivers in there now that are a wealth of knowledge, and they are the real experts. I will keep doing more deep dives into therapies, into the science. I am looking for, just like you, what can help. And if I heard things like that, if I heard the science that neurofeedback worked, not only would I be telling you that, I'd probably open a flipping clinic. You know, but always listen to the science, not the salesman, and make sure that the salesman has, like bipartisan information on it. You spend a lot of money. It's a lot of time. And if I can help you avoid some of that stuff, then I feel good about that. Okay. But again, I'm not telling you what to do. Do your thing. I'm just glad you listen. And hopefully you got some insight, but exciting stuff, that they found the changes, not only in the young kids, but, when they revisited that 4 years later. That's off the charts. That's what I like to hear. And that's why it's so important to not only, you know, read the science, but be a part of the science. And so if there's ever a chance that you could be a part of a study, a legit study, like, do it, because that's part of the answer. That's how we are going to that's how we are going to move forward with this and get some answers, is by backing up the researchers who are kicking so much ass doing it. All right. I've gone on enough. I think I've proved my point. What you do is amazing. What you do is good. What you do is important. Please do not give up. These kids need you. You are the expert on your kid. I can't tell you how much respect I have for you. And I know it might not feel like you are a good parent, but I'm telling you, you are, because if you're listening to this, you're surviving. And hopefully you keep listening to the show so we can keep you not only surviving, but you could thrive in this. You could do this. You are a good parent. You could have good outcomes for your kids. We could create useful futures. We could do it. It just takes a really good education, training, a community, all of that good stuff, which I will definitely cover in future episodes. Again, if you like what you're hearing, folks, please don't hesitate to subscribe and follow and like whatever it is you do with the podcast provider that you have. So keep kicking ass, man. I love you. We're going to be back here next week with another awesome interview. I can't wait for you to hear it. I can't wait for you to have better days. They are on the horizon. You're awesome. I love you. I'll see you next week. Bye.